provided by Thomas Allgaier and Frinnis, based on the most relevant posts on LinkedIn about defense tech in CW 48 and 49. Frinnis is a B2B market research company that equips product and strategy teams with market and competitive intelligence across the defense industry. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're doing a rapid scan of the top defense tech trends we've seen bubbling up on LinkedIn over the last 2 weeks. That's calendar weeks 48 and 49.
Exactly.
We've tried to cut through the noise to find the real signal, and what we're seeing is this steady critical momentum in a few key areas.
For sure. I mean, we're talking autonomy, sensors, command and control, and AI.
And especially how these things are actually being debated and, you know, implemented within the European defense ecosystem, which is fascinating right now.
It is. And this isn't about white papers. We're looking at what people who are actually in the industry are sharing. And we saw, what, four major themes kind of crystallizing?
Yeah.
You've got the race towards truly autonomous systems, the absolute need for layered counter UAS stacks, and then this sort of sudden arrival of generative AI in strategic planning.
And the last one, which might be the most important.
Oh, absolutely. The growing urgency to fix how we buy and field all this new tech.
That structural piece is huge. But okay, let's start with the hardware and the code. Our first theme, uncrewed systems and the autonomy horizon.
Right.
The big story here isn't just that drones exist. It's how little space is left between a human supervising the operation and, well, full autonomous decision making.
And this is where it gets really serious. What stood out, and this is noted by Aviv Barzohar, is how close we are to crossing a major threshold with international humanitarian law.
What do you mean?
Well, frontline drones are already getting AI-generated strike recommendations. The operator's there, but they're just giving the final okay.
So it's less of a decision and more of a final confirmation, a checkbox.
A checkbox.
Oh.
Exactly. It's a tiny but absolutely critical step away from lethal autonomous weapons making that final call all by themselves.
The legal and ethical side of that is just enormous.
It's huge. And as these systems get more powerful, the question of accountability if an AI gets it wrong, I mean, fratricide, civilian casualties, that gets harder to answer, not easier.
Okay, that's the ethical complexity. Let's pivot from that risk to the reality of what's being fielded. We saw some really successful experiments linking unmanned systems across the entire kill chain.
You must be thinking of the Haraka Storm exercise in Kenya.
That's the one.
Yeah, a textbook case of integrating tech quickly. Joseph Truelove and George Huckel detailed how it all worked. You had the ARX Robotics Chirion UGV.
The ground vehicle.
Right, the UGV. It detected and classified a target, an armored vehicle. That data moves super fast to HQ. And then an HX2 delivered the effect.
So what does a demo like that actually prove strategically? Is it just a cool test?
No, it proves that really short decision cycles are achievable. I mean, the time from spotting something to hitting it used to be minutes, sometimes hours. Now we're compressing that.
And that speed is the new measure of combat effectiveness.
It is, and they demonstrated it in the field.
Speaking of fielding advanced stuff, Endural and EdG Group launched the Omen VTOL AAV. Torsten Staub flagged this, and it feels like a big shift in platform size and capability.
The Omen is a really interesting aircraft. It's a hybrid electric tail-sitting platform.
So vertical takeoff and landing, no runway needed.
Exactly. But the key thing here is that it has the payload and the range you'd normally see on a much bigger Group 4 or 5 drone.
But with the flexibility of a smaller platform.
That's the game changer. It shifts you away from relying on big, vulnerable air bases.
It's all about that operational flexibility. And Endural seems to be betting everything on just accumulating massive amounts of operational data.
Well, Jared Wilson pointed out something that's just mind-boggling. Their autonomous undersea vehicles have clocked over 40,100 kilometers of mission time.
That's more than the circumference of the Earth.
It is. And if you're in this industry, that fact should define your perspective. You cannot simulate that kind of real-world complexity. The live data from actual ocean currents, salinity, noise, it's just so much better for training your AI models.
That kind of operational experience becomes a competitive moat that legacy firms just can't match.
Yep. And that leads us perfectly into our second and honestly deeply frustrating theme, procurement, iteration, and the industrial base.
Because all this amazing tech means absolutely nothing if the procurement system just stops it cold.
You said it. You can have the best AI on the planet, but if your acquisition process was built for 1980, you are failing your warfighters.
And the evidence for this is just dramatic. Arda Moroz cited it.
The U.S. Army Secretary's statement.
Yeah. saying contractors have, and I'm quoting, conned the U.S. military into these insanely expensive buys. The example was that helicopter knob.
$47,000.
For a part you could buy for $15,000, it's almost hard to believe.
It is, but it keeps happening. And like Moreau said, that's not a supply chain issue. It's a failure of the procurement architecture itself.
It rewards complexity and vendor lock-in, not performance.
Exactly. Which is why reform isn't just a nice idea anymore. It's an operational necessity.
So if that's the broken model, what does a functional one look like?
It looks market-driven. It looks performance-based. Look at what's happening with Ukraine's Brave E1 market.
It's been called an Amazon for the military.
That's a great way to put it. It forces providers to compete on pure performance. Capabilities, pricing, reviews, it's all visible. The soldiers on the front line choose what actually works.
And the system rewards battlefield results, not who has the best lobbyists.
It completely flips the incentive structure. You have to optimize for speed and capability, not just margin on a slow contract.
But that requires a whole cultural shift, especially in how we view development and testing.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because when a company like Anduril runs rapid tests, the media often jumps on any failures.
I've seen that. And it totally misses the point of iteration.
It does. Madeline Hart and Matt Bebb both stress this. Failing a lot isn't a bug. It's a feature of iterative development.
You have to break things to make them better.
Of course. That's how you get reliable capability.
Mm.
You find the bugs, fix them, ship again, and repeat until the thing is solid.
It's about compressing that time to relevance, right? The difference between a 10-year cycle and a 10-month one.
Exactly. So once you have fast tech and a better procurement system, what's left? Matt McCran argued that once you clear a certain tech threshold, it all comes down to leadership.
Interesting.
His point is that the companies that really build momentum are the ones obsessed with the customer and aligned around the mission, not just the next contract.
Mm-hmm.
Cool tech alone is not a sustainable advantage.
And that focus on execution is really gaining steam in Europe. Florian Seibel highlighted the recent valuation uplift for Quantum Systems,
which is a huge signal of investor confidence in European dual-use scaling. The bet is on agile private companies.
And that feeds into a broader strategic vision from Mark A. Whitefeld. He's arguing Europe has to connect its military innovation with its existing industrial base.
Yes. Think about it. How can an automotive supply chain adapt to produce drone parts faster than a traditional aerospace firm?
By using the scale and precision manufacturing they already have.
That's the connection Europe needs to make for sustainable deterrence.
Okay, so let's try to connect all these pieces. Theme three is C2, networks, and layered defense. This is where it all comes together.
And where you have to deal with the sheer number of threats, like drones.
Kirill Jokimovich had a great take on this. He argues modern war is a sensor war, not a drone war.
Yeah, the old idea of a continuous front line is just gone. It's replaced by these dense, interconnected kill zones.
So the system of observation and coordination is more important than the specs of any one drone.
Infinitely more important.
If it's a sensor war, then integrated air defense is the answer. And MBDA seems to be having a lot of success here. They secured an export contract for their Sky Warden system.
And it won the Frontex Prize 2025. That's a big deal.
A real mark of maturity.
Florent Toulou and Stephen Arbib pointed out that its strength is how integrated it is. It blends advanced sensors, AI-enabled C2, and a bunch of different effectors.
Like the Helipi laser and the Mistral III missile.
Right. And that blend is the key innovation.
Why is that? Why not just one or the other?
Because you need layers. The laser is great for short-range swarms. High volume, low cost per shot. But the missile gives you the range and kinetic punch for bigger or faster targets.
It's about having the right tool for the right threat.
It's robust, flexible, and ultimately more cost-effective.
And we see that same layered idea on platforms themselves. Robin Ryan was discussing Rheinmetall Strike Shield.
Strike Shield is a perfect example. It's a hybrid active-passive system. Its design is modular, so it minimizes weight. But crucially, it also minimizes the electronic signature.
So you're not a giant blinking target on the battlefield.
Precisely. And that principle is now the standard for modern CUAS concepts.
We're also seeing big wins in pure C2. Kylas Erickson noted that Anduril was selected for the U.S. Army's IBCSM program.
That's a massive step. The Integrated Battle Command System. It basically solidifies their Lattice platform for counter-UAS fire control.
And in Europe.
They're making progress. The EDOCC project, the European Defense Operational Collaborative Cloud, had its successful final presentation. Harold Mannheim confirmed they showed off autonomous C2 systems using cloud tech.
A real leap forward for collective defense over there.
For sure.
Okay, let's hit our final theme. Generative AI for strategy and wargaming. This is where things move off the physical battlefield and into the planning room.
Yeah, this is all about getting to continuous foresight. Laura Samso detailed how Gen AI is changing strategy through AI-supported wargaming.
Like the new Gen War Lab at Johns Hopkins APL.
Exactly. The goal is to move past these slow, episodic planning cycles and toward continuous, model-driven scenario exploration.
So instead of a two-week paper exercise, you can test thousands of what-if scenarios really, really fast.
Right. What are the risks of using it in that environment?
Well, the model could be predictable. Or worse, it could have some kind of hidden bias baked in.
Exactly. If it hallucinates a scenario that seems real but is statistically unlikely, any strategy you build on that is going to be flawed from the start.
Which is why you need labs like GenWar to verify and validate these models.
Mm-hmm. And operationally, security is everything here. Ismail Alvarez made a great point about the difference between open weight and open source models.
A distinction a lot of people miss.
And it's crucial for security teams. Open source means everything is public, code, data, all of it. Open weight means the model's parameters are public, but the training data and code might not be.
So defense agencies can get the capability and flexibility of the model without exposing the core platform.
That's the balancing act. And it's no surprise the primes are moving fast. Jacob Sprague noted that the Lockheed Martin AI Center is partnering directly with Skunkworks engineers to enhance their autonomy products.
So it's not stuck in a lab. It's getting integrated right into the development stream.
As fast as possible.
Okay, so let's summarize this deep dive. We've seen autonomy maturing, which brings successes like Haraka Storm, but also these huge ethical warnings. We've seen urgent calls for procurement reform.
The $47,000 knob problem.
Right, and the push for market-based models like BRAV-E1. And then finally, the systemic integration across C2, sensors, and the industrial base, all now being supported by the first serious uses of Gen AI in wargaming.
And if you connect all those threads, there was one thing that was mentioned over and over, kind of as a silent assumption. Resilient PNT, position, navigation, and timing.
Backed by space links.
Yes. We just assume GPS and comms will be there. But they aren't guarantees. They're assumptions that have to be stress tested. And that leaves a pretty provocative question for everyone listening, whether you're a strategist or a product leader.
What's that?
What steps are you taking today to make sure your systems are resilient and can actually operate in a contested PNT environment? Because that backbone we all assume will be there, that could be the next single point of failure.
A compelling and very necessary challenge to end on. If you enjoyed this deep dive, new editions drop every 2 weeks. Also, check out our other editions on ICT and Tech Insights, Health Tech, Cloud, Digital Products and Services, Artificial Intelligence, and Sustainability and Green ICT. Thank you for joining us, and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss the next rapid download of crucial strategic intelligence.